This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. So look, I mean, honestly, what do we think is going to happen in the next, 7 days? Because that really is the main economic thing right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Riznall. The 24th of July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So here we are, another Friday in our virus summer. The economy is stressed. Consumers are too. Big companies are making money. Small ones kind of not. And really, nobody knows how this is going to turn out. Neither do we, of course, but we can make some educated guesses. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you and this quote from Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, the Senate Majority Leader. He said today, speaking of the next economic rescue package, he said, "We hope to have something passed by the end of the next few weeks." Do you suppose he knows that things expire like in 2-3 days?
He does know. Mitch McConnell is a smart man. He does know these things. But the fact that he is that open about the fact that it could take weeks should be concerning, because he recognizes the fault lines within his party and obviously across Congress about what this moment means. Are we in a moment like we were in March, where things are that bad and they need to act quickly? Or are we in a recovery period? Mitch McConnell has compared this to needing physical therapy for the economy rather than life support. A lot of economists would disagree with that at this moment, and we're going to find out how bad it gets if they don't come forward.
One imagines, Gina Smilek, that the bet that Republicans were making, right, because we've known these expirations were coming in extra unemployment insurance and eviction moratoriums and those things. We've known they're coming for quite a while. One imagines the bets they were making were the economy is going to be better, and so we're going to have some time.
Right, right. And I think there was this bright moment where it looked like that might be possible back when we were making these early decisions, because, you know, the virus was improving. It was waning for a while, and you know, it seemed like maybe the economy was going to reopen without incident. I think they kind of bet the whole house on that. And now we're really seeing a situation where the virus is resurging. Many people are still out of work. We've got the worst unemployment rate since World War II. And a lot of people are going to be left out in the cold without substantial help from the government, because this is going to take too long to get through.
Sudeep, just real quick on this, and then I want to move on to a couple of other things. A two-part question. Number one, is there any doubt that there's a new package that comes? And number two, who's it going to be closer to, the Republicans' $1 trillion or the Democrats in the House and their $3.5 trillion?
This, I think, largely depends on whether anybody in Congress or enough people in Congress remember the debt ceiling or remember the fiscal cliff or remember TARP. Because if they do, if they remember those moments, then they will know that markets will respond when they're not getting enough government aid to support the economy. And so part of this depends on whether markets panic before or after lawmakers act. My gut is that lawmakers are going to take their time, markets will panic, and then things will end up a lot closer to where the Democrats are than where the Republicans are, because when you see markets dropping, a lot of Republicans start paying attention very quickly.
We will consider that a timestamp right here. We've got it on tape, too. Gina, let me turn to the Federal Reserve and a woman by the name of Judy Shelton, a not uncontroversial nominee who passed the Senate Banking Committee this week. She will go for a full vote in the Senate whenever that gets scheduled. If she passes, it'll be along party lines. She is controversial for a couple of reasons. Remind us what those are, and then the ramifications of that for monetary policy.
Right. So she is controversial for a few big reasons. Probably the largest is that she has been a lifelong supporter of the gold standard. She would say it's not the traditional gold standard that you are thinking of. She sort of has an idea for how to revamp the gold standard. But at the end of the day, she's a hard money fan. So that's very controversial, because most economists, pretty much all mainstream economists, say that it would be wildly damaging to go back to anything that looks like a gold standard given the current environment and current economy and the structure. So that's A. The other thing that makes her very controversial is she has close ties to the Trump White House. She advised the 2016 campaign. She worked on the transition team. She was originally nominated to an international job by the Trump administration. And she has kind of consistently been a cheerleader for Trump's administration in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, you know, on press interviews just repeatedly over time. And people are worried that she would not be an independent actor at the Fed, which is really concerning, because there have been murmurs that she would be a clear heir to Jerome Powell if Trump would win re-election. And so there's this real possibility that she could be nominated as Fed chair. And if she's not independent and she's nominated as Fed chair, then, you know, we have all kinds of problems.
Okay, so deep China, lots of back and forth on consulate closures, many not kind words being spoken by both sides. How worried ought one be about the decoupling of these two largest economies in the world?
This seems like a series of powerful forces that are building up under the surface of the volcano, and at some point it will erupt.
Oh, good. Oh, great. That's great.
But I don't feel like we're there yet, because despite all of the chatter you have from the U.S. and from China, the tough talk, the harsh words, they both realize that if one goes down, the other goes down as well. Both of their economies will collapse. The U.S. and the Chinese economies will tumble. Markets will tumble at the same time. That's not what anyone wants in this moment, particularly in at a time when everyone's dealing with a virus still. So I think they're just going to keep throwing as much mud at each other as they possibly can, and hope that nothing breaks in the process. But as usual, it's always a hope.
Lots of markets tumbling talk out of you today. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Gina Smilek at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street on a Friday in late July, kind of wilted. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we talked about, Gina and Sudeep and I, the end of this month is looking grim. Unemployment is still north of 11%. Eviction moratoriums are expiring federally and in states across the country. Last month, just for some context here, about 20% of renters didn't pay their full amount due. And as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, getting evicted can go on your permanent financial record.
Getting evicted can make it hard to rent again. Peter Hepburn from the Princeton Eviction Lab says,
we've spoken with property managers in a number of states who've told us point blank that they won't rent to someone who has been filed against for eviction. And it doesn't even matter whether they were actually evicted, just whether that eviction process was started.
One problem is many landlords screen prospective renters using data collection agencies, which put an eviction court filing on a tenant's record, even if that filing never led to an actual eviction. And depending on the state you live in, once it's on your record, it's not going away. Nicole Paluzzi is a housing attorney with Charleston Pro Bono Legal Services in South Carolina, the state with the highest eviction rates in the country.
When you have an eviction filing in South Carolina, that civil filing record remains permanent.
And Diane Yentel from the National Low Income Housing Coalition says the stigma of an eviction on record means tenants
end up usually having to rent in less desirable neighborhoods because those are the landlords that will take them. So there's this spiraling down into poverty that can happen from just one eviction filing.
And advocates are warning that millions more Americans who cannot pay rent might find themselves in that spiral soon. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
The Rio Grande Valley, down in South Texas, is a coronavirus hotspot. In some cities along the Mexican border, hospitals are full, funeral homes are running out of space, and the federal government has sent mobile morgues and doctors and nurses. A judge in Hidalgo County has ordered people to stay at home, with exceptions for essential travel. The catch, of course, is that Texas Governor Greg Abbott says local stay-at-home orders are no good. Marketplace's Andy Euler spoke with some people down there to get a sense of things.
Hidalgo County Judge Richard Cortez has found himself at the center of controversy over his stay-at-home orders. He issued his first back in March.
I received a lot of criticism for it because some people lost their jobs, some people couldn't go to work, some businesses couldn't open.
But he says the first lockdown worked, limiting COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths to just a handful of people. Then in late April, Governor Greg Abbott started reopening the Texas economy, overriding local orders. And the virus surged, especially in the Rio Grande Valley. In Hidalgo County alone, more than 400 people have now died. And on Monday, Cortez re-upped the stay-at-home order.
I had to take desperate measures. And even though I went against the governor's, you know, position of not putting shelter in place, I thought the facts and circumstances found in Hidalgo County required me to take that drastic action.
But the governor's office said Cortez has no mechanism to enforce the stay-at-home order, no fines or jail time. And that's because there's no statewide shelter-in-place mandate, which Abbott calls a last resort. In his order, Judge Cortez strongly recommended but did not require that non-essential businesses close shop. Steve Elanius with the McAllen Chamber of Commerce says that's a tough ask.
Every business person I've talked to said, I will do whatever it takes, but I cannot afford to close down a second time. But I don't think anybody is saying, you know, I'm going to throw caution to the wind and I'm just going to open up and go back to what it was before.
Eleni says it's been difficult for businesses to negotiate the politics of the pandemic, making sure they're following all of the rules.
Yeah, a lot of confusion, right? We got a lot of different elected leaders saying different things.
It's something of a power struggle with lives at stake.
What we've seen in Texas specifically is a desire by Governor Abbott to have it both ways.
That's Lindsay Wiley at American University Washington College of Law.
So at times he has emphasized that local governments do have control, but the reality is that he has blocked most local measures.
Governor Abbott didn't respond to an interview request, but this week he did tell a Rio Grande Valley TV station that area is the state's top priority for controlling the virus. The state sent 1,200 medical personnel there this week, and more are coming.
Our key focus right now is surging medical resources into the Rio Grande Valley to make sure that the medical needs of the people in the region are fully addressed.
Elsewhere in Texas, the mayor of Austin and a county judge in Houston have also battled with Abbott over local orders that the governor said overstepped state mandates. In Georgia, the governor is suing the mayor of Atlanta over a mask requirement in her city. Lindsay Wiley at American University says these battles between states and local authorities are arising in part because of Washington, D.C.
What the federal role here should be is clear messaging, clear guidance, and resources. and they've failed to deliver on all of those responsibilities.
She says the response to the pandemic has become far too political at all levels of government. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace. Coming up.
Yeah, a cooling center doesn't have to be a government building with the words cooling center stamped on it.
Summer heat and cities and this pandemic. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials down 182 points on this Friday, 0.6%, 26,469. The NASDAQ down 98 points, about 0.9%, 10,363. The S&P 500 slid 20. That's points. 0.6 is the percent, 32 and 15. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 0.7%, the NASDAQ down 1.3%, the S&P 500 gave back about 0.2%. The oil-filled services company Schlumberger is eliminating about 21,000 jobs as oil producers cut back on spending. Energy companies, of course, have been hit hard by falling oil prices as the pandemic depresses demand. Schlumberger picked up 0.9%. Today, rival Halliburton down 0.2%. Baker Hughes retreated 1.9%. Today, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose. It rose to 0.58%. It's a little lower than it's been. Low interest rates are not a sign of economic growth. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now, a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back at the end of March, beginning of April-ish, when quarantine got real, businesses, some of them anyway, started giving their essential workers hazard pay, typically a $2 an hour bump. Here we are, 4 months later, and even though the virus is raging in big parts of this country, hazard pay has mostly disappeared. So now states are stepping in. Pennsylvania, for instance, established a grant program this week for businesses to offer bonuses for workers in healthcare and transit, food manufacturing, and retail as well. So on the theory that workers risking their health in a perilous economy deserve something, who should pay for it? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
$16 an hour. That's how much Rashad Lloyd was making at Total Wine & More in Virginia in March. Now he's making $14 because his hazard pay expired in April, and he feels pretty stuck. It's not like there are a lot of other jobs out there.
There's absolutely no alternative right now, and a lot of these companies understand that there's no alternative.
At the beginning of the pandemic, companies were worried employees wouldn't show up to work. But now?
The power dynamics have changed. Employers are more easily finding workers, and so they're decreasing the incentives to bring workers into the workplace.
Erin Hatton teaches labor sociology at the University at Buffalo. She says companies also feel like they don't have to pay extra because stay-at-home orders have lifted. And aside from the Amazons and Krogers of the world, a lot of businesses can't afford to give hazard pay forever.
Business owners need to be supported by governments. I mean, this cannot be an employer enterprise.
So what would that support look like? Nicole Hallett teaches labor law at the University of Chicago.
Really, there are three options.
She says governments could force companies to pay up, though that means businesses already struggling would continue to foot the bill. Or they could offer incentives like tax breaks or fund hazard pay programs themselves. And a government mandate would do something else, create rules and guidelines.
The definition of what we consider to be hazardous work and what is hazardous work has changed.
Before the pandemic, we would have never called the grocery store worker's job dangerous. And now that we've reopened much of the economy, with the virus still a threat, you could argue hairstylists and restaurant servers are doing dangerous work, too. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
One of the reasons the global economy works as smoothly as it does, most of the time, is that all those interlocking supply chains are well-oiled machines. Everything gets where it needs to be when it needs to be there, no sooner, no later, until a pandemic hits. Because just-in-time manufacturing and unexpected spikes in demand do not good partners make. We've seen a couple of examples the past couple of months. Think toilet paper, right? Now, it's cans. Demand for canned goods is so strong, wholesale distributors are running out of empties to pack up the soups and the chili and the tuna and all that kind of stuff. Marketplace's Scott Tong has our supply chain story today.
James Kwan is the CEO of ePallets, a technology and logistics company that connects food manufacturers and buyers. He says a shortage of cans means foods that are normally unavailable for a week or two are now delayed for months.
Especially in ready-to-eat meals, like chili, soups, and prepared meats, the cans are in short supply.
Kwan says materials like tin and steel from China are scarce, as are labels for cans. He says one food manufacturer had labels sent by plane instead of ships to get them quickly. Still, he worries about people who rely on canned food.
Senior citizens, school kids who are requiring these emergency food packs, and the newly unemployed. Waiting a month to 3 months is just unrealistic.
And as the pandemic worsens, demand for non-perishable food is spiking again. The analytics firm IRI says grocery store purchases are up 13%, but soup is up 25%. IRI Vice President Joan Driggs.
I would not associate with the peak of summer to be when people would be purchasing things like condensed soup or canned chili. But the sales levels for those products are up significantly.
Still, from a business perspective, it may not make sense for soup and canned companies to spend on supersizing production if things return to normal, say in a year. Rudy Leuschner teaches supply chain management at Rutgers.
We all wanted to go back to the way it was. And I also don't think that when all of this is over, that people are going to keep hoarding weeks of food in their house.
Before this pandemic, sales of soup and other canned foods had been trending down. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Every time we turn around, it seems, scientists are telling us this year or even this month is among the hottest on record. And in fact, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says this summer is going to be hotter than average across pretty much the whole country. But even in an average summer, heat kills hundreds of Americans. Cooling centers have been, and they still are, a popular solution. But as Marketplace's Eric Barris reports, getting a bunch of people into air-conditioned rooms in the middle of a pandemic is a little problematic.
In the age of social distancing and trying to keep people from spreading COVID-19, do you invite them to leave their homes and congregate under a communal HVAC system to stay safe from the heat?
It's a hard time because every choice we have seems to be a decision between two really bad options.
That's Eric Kleinenberg, a sociologist at NYU who wrote a book about the 1995 Chicago heat wave that killed more than 700 people. That prompted cities to start opening cooling centers. That worked fine until this year, because as Jackson, Mississippi Chief Administrative Officer Robert Blaine says,
the same communities that are vulnerable to challenges from heat are also most vulnerable to the virus as well.
That is the poor, the elderly, and people of color. Jackson is 85% Black. And in a typical summer, the city has at least 25 days when the heat index rises above 95 and it opens cooling centers. But this year, Blaine says,
we have not opened centers because we've been concerned about our ability, our resources, to control social distancing in those spaces.
Cities across the country are facing the same tough decision. Christy Ebi researches the health risks of climate variability at the University of Washington. She says it's not an either or.
Cities can't do one or the other. They can't either protect their citizens from heat or protect their citizens from COVID-19. They have to do both.
Before the pandemic, people had a lot of options when it got hot, says sociologist Eric Kleinenberg.
A cooling center doesn't have to be a government building with the words cooling center stamped on it. It can be a mall. It can be a movie theater. It can be a restaurant. It can be a coffee shop. The problem this summer is that many of those places are closed.
And that has left cities scrambling.
Instead of careful planning now, we're getting all sorts of ad hoc measures.
Phoenix has used its convention center as a cooling center. Philadelphia parked city buses and kept the AC running. New York City is just giving away air conditioners. But some places aren't doing anything because of state orders. Mark Steeman, a geography professor at Cal State Chico, worked on the city's extreme heat plan. Chico's cooling centers?
They've canceled that program, and we're really just running without anything right now.
And that's a problem. Chico already was strapped and recently gained around 20,000 residents who had been displaced by wildfires.
As these disasters kind of stack up on top of each other, they just become more and more difficult for a community like ours.
For now, they're distributing cold water to homeless camps and low-income residents as temperatures climb above 100 degrees, while trying to stop COVID-19 from spreading in the community and planning how to evacuate as wildfires break out. And while all of that happens, Steeman says the city doesn't have the capacity to make long-term plans. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Amazon tries to atone, I guess, for its part in our combined contributions to the cardboard recycling stream. Lots more people ordering stuff online, lots more boxes, many more crowded recycling containers, right? So Amazon is out with, and this is actually real, a list of fun ways to reuse your Amazon boxes. You could, the company says, build a box fort or a cat condo or a windmill. For mini golf. I mean, you could, but somehow I expected more, you know? All right, we are going, but first, your moment of economic context to end this week. Precious metals division. Gold closed at a record high today, $1,897.50 per troy ounce. The first record the shiny yellow stuff has hit in 9 years, by the way. Safe haven in troubled times, or just a good, solid, diversified investment? You decide. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good and safe weekend, will you? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.